And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In anticipation of Mother's Day, which of course is Sunday, I want to replay for you a memorable conversation from 2007 with Lori Leibovich, the author and editor of a really incredible book called Maybe Baby. 28 writers tell the truth about skepticism, infertility, baby lust, childlessness, ambivalence, and how they made the biggest decision of their lives. That subtitle really says it all. This is 28 different writers telling their own stories of wrestling with the question of whether or not to be mothers. The book is published by Harper Perennial. You say in the book's introduction, you were overwhelmed by the deluge of mail which came in the wake of the start of this series, and you say what made our readers so passionate about the question of whether or not to breed. For the first time in history, parenthood is not a given. People have new and often confusing choices when it comes to having children. All of the old rules about childbearing no longer apply. Talk a moment about that and remind us of just what drastic changes we're talking about in this respect.
Sure. What was so interesting when, and again, this instant rapport that we had with our readers when we ran the series of essays, which was 5 essays in the magazine, the letters were not only were we deluged with hundreds and hundreds of them, but they were of the most personal and passionate nature of anything that we had really published previously, which was saying a lot considering the kinds of topics that we generally cover. And what we were realizing, what we were hearing from our readers and our audience, was that the reason this question has become so important in the last, decade or so, is that the landscape of parenting has changed in that people they can opt out of parenthood, women can opt out of being mothers in a way that wasn't socially acceptable even 20 years ago. And it still isn't completely, but it's getting more and more acceptable. Gay and lesbians who want to be parents now have a lot more options than they generally used to have. They didn't usually have options at all. And there's a whole new, because of reproductive technology and because women who previously might have been too old or unable to have children now have more options in that way, people who, again, a generation ago would have been not had the option to have biological children now do have that option. And so the whole landscape has shifted, and people who previously would not have been able to consider parenthood now are able to, and people that always would have been assumed to become parents, generally, heterosexual men and women, can choose not to, and it's a lot more acceptable and a lot more common.
And so for that reason, you have so many people confronting this in an entirely different way.
Exactly.
Than would have once upon a time been the case.
Exactly.
And in many cases, when they were themselves being parented, it was in a completely different world in that old landscape.
Right, exactly. And we heard that a lot in the letters, and certainly sort of among our staff, our parents, I'm 36. My mother never would have thought that she wouldn't, it was sort of her duty almost to get married and have children. Whereas for me, it would have been just fine to make other choices just a generation later.
We should mention that in what you call kind of an interesting case of life imitating art, I guess is the way you say it, is that almost immediately upon beginning work on this book, Maybe Baby, you yourself became pregnant for the first time. Tell us a little bit about how that affected you, and specifically how it affected your work on this book.
Sure. It was a coincidence. It was about 3 weeks after we decided we were going to make this into a book, and I began working on the project, that I found out I was pregnant. And like a lot of women of my generation and my, sort of age, it was incredibly confusing, even though I had always known I'd wanted children, even though it wasn't completely unplanned. I had this great, you know, I was so engaged in this project and putting this book together, and all of a sudden the pregnancy was, I wouldn't say getting in the way of it, but it was very, you know, it was difficult to work as hard as I was used to working and put together an ambitious project like this. So I was confronted very, very, very personally with this sense of wanting to have it all and not really knowing how to do it and still, you know, get some sleep at night. And I, you know, what was really interesting, though, is throughout the 9 months of the pregnancy really almost entirely coincided with me editing these 28 pieces. And when you're working on personal essays with writers, there you have an intimacy. You're talking about people's, you know, deepest and most important decisions. I really was able to learn a lot from these writers myself, which I hope obviously every reader learns a lot from their pieces as well. But the joys and the trials of parenthood became much more clear to me even before I had my son, just from weaving through these essays with people. And at the same time, the sort of freedoms accorded to people who did not have children were also becoming very clear to me, because here I was trying to balance so many different things, and the writers who in this book talk a lot about the you know, the freedoms of not having children are artists who get to really, really passionately and without any kind of limitations explore their lives. And I was feeling a little bit confined at the time too. Mm. You know, knowing that I couldn't go too, you know, my professional life was changing.
Right.
Because of this.
You talked about feeling sort of hijacked, physically hijacked,
yeah,
by the experience of being pregnant and knocked a bit sideways, although all eventually went well. And
yeah,
you have a beautiful first son,
yes,
with whom you're very much in love, and you're glad he's here.
I'm very glad he's here, yes. I am, and I'm very glad his sibling will be here soon. But these aren't easy questions to wrestle with, and I think, you know, that's the purpose of a book like this, is that even if it doesn't change your mind necessarily about what you're eventually going to do or try to do about parenthood, it gives you a broader perspective on other people's choices, and that can help.
Right. How did you gather these 28 particular writers together?
Mm-hmm.
That had to be a very complicated, difficult process, I should think.
Yeah, it was not. It wasn't. It took a while. A lot of it, you know, there are a few essays in the book that, of course, originally ran in Salon, and the person who I asked to do the foreword, Anne Lamott, is a very beloved author who has written sort of a classic book about parenthood called Operating Instructions, about mothering her son as a single mother in his first year. And that book, to me and to many other women, is sort of a touchstone. And Anne was someone who has written for Salon extensively over the years, and I instantly wanted her to be a part of it because I thought her perspective was so valuable. And the rest of the group, really, it was sort of putting out feelers, asking people that I knew who had interesting stories about becoming a parent or not. Someone like Lionel Shriver, who writes in the book about why she's adamantly against having a child, had just written a novel called We Need to Talk About Kevin, which was written from the perspective of a mother whose teenage son had gone on a Columbine-style shooting spree and killed a bunch of other teenagers. And in the novel, this mother wrestles with whether or not she ever should have had him. And I thought, you know, I didn't know anything about Lionel's background, but I thought I would contact her and sort of try to see if there was anything in her fiction that was similar to her real life. And of course, it wasn't as explosive as the novel, but she did have very strong feelings about not becoming a parent. So a lot of it was working with writers who I, you know, and trying, just contacting writers who I admired, like Rick Moody, and whose work I've always enjoyed, and Lauren Slater, who's a magazine writer and a novelist, and just asking them their stories, and more often than not, they had some interesting ones.
So. Right. And the book breaks down roughly into even fashion with those who do not want children, those who are parents, and those who are, I think the section is titled On the Fence,
yes.
Those who are wrestling, struggling with whether or not to take this step forward.
Mm-hmm.
Let's talk about Anne Lamott for just a moment. Her introduction, or her foreword, I think, is especially interesting. And she talks about how she had certain images of what motherhood would feel like, and she says much of it was fantasy. She said, "I was unprepared for how lumpy the living water of parenthood would be and how much grit comes with it." She really thought something kind of magical was going to occur, and she wouldn't exactly call it magic. She says it's a lot of starts, stops, lurching, flailing, and coasting, then braking, barely in control again, gears grinding, and then something easing us forward. And that's a theme which we hear time and time again. Those who are kind of surprised by what a bumpy, though maybe ultimately wonderful ride this usually is.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of mythology around parenthood. There's a lot of commercial images of parenthood. There's the mother sitting with their child in a rocking chair, glowing and, you know, bathed in sunlight and looking, you know, just completely blissed out. And I think if you are honest with yourself and you get some new parents together, we can all really attest to the fact that those moments are really few and far between, and actually not just new parenthood, but parenthood throughout is, as Anne says, much more bumpy than it is bathed in that sunny light. And I think one of the things, as I mentioned, Anne's book about parenthood operating instructions did, and now there's an entire genre of nonfiction writing about parenthood that sort of owes itself to her, is that she wrote very clearly and honestly about the difficult moments, the messy moments, the frustrating moments, the moments when you are more angry than you are in love with your child. And I think she broke a lot of barriers that way. And as a result, we have maybe a glut of literature now, and magazine articles and web articles that sort of explore the underbelly of parenthood. And but I think that's much preferable to keeping it bathed in that mythology. I think it's much more honest now.
Right. Well, especially if a young mother finds herself with not much of that glow which she's seen in commercials, and is probably embarrassed to say anything about it to anybody else. I mean, what a terrible thing to sort of harbor in private,
exactly.
these misgivings and this bewilderment,
exactly.
That this isn't what it was supposed to be.
Exactly. And I think actually the internet has been really critical in helping parents who feel isolated and alone in this project to feel more connected, because there is a vast network. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of parenting sites and message boards and places where people can anonymously post about these trials and tribulations, and they can feel a sense of connectedness that, you know, that they might not feel in their real non-virtual life.
We're talking with Lori Leibovich about the book Maybe Baby. She edited this book, which is a collection of 28 essays by 28 different writers talking about the experience of either having children or thinking about having children or deciding not to have children. And one thing, actually, I can't find the line now, but somebody talks about how for them in the wrestling, it was maybe something where they felt like it would be okay to have a child, but they really didn't have much interest at all in raising a child.
Yeah.
And it's so interesting to think about breaking down the question in that way.
Yeah.
That whereas probably a lot of people have kind of jumped into it thinking of it sort of as one decision or one experience, when in fact being pregnant, giving birth, and those sort of early days, that gives way to something which in a sense might be very, very different. And you might feel very prepared and called to the one and maybe not so much to the other.
Yeah, I think the line you're referring to appears in an essay by Michelle Goldberg, who was a nonfiction writer. And she, at the time that she wrote her essay, she was 27, very happily married, very, very ambitious. She's an outstanding journalist. And she, her essay is a lot about the feeling that she's worried that she's very ambivalent about having children, but she's very also very worried that she's going to regret it if she doesn't. And as you say, there is a difference, I think, and maybe it's generational in the sense that this, you know, the generation that's becoming parents now or of parenting age now isn't used to seeing, you know, is used to seeing their lives incrementally. And so for her, she isn't much interested in pregnancy, birth, toddlerhood, the kind of, you know, the sort of endless trudge, as Anne Lamott called it, through those early years. She's much more interested, I think, in having a fully formed human being as a son or daughter.
If only such a thing were possible.
Right.
Yeah. She writes at one point, I can sort of see that it might be nice to have children,
yeah,
but there are 1,000 things I'd rather spend my time doing then raise them. The daily grind of motherhood seems like a prison sentence to me. I mean, it's so amazing to think about her publicly writing those words when, as you pointed out earlier in the interview, it was really unthinkable to express such a thought not all that long ago. I mean, people would really think there was something wrong with you if you held this opinion.
And just to be clear, there were some severe negative reactions to this essay, and this one was one of the ones that was originally published on Salon. So it hasn't quite, you know, it's not quite, we're not so enlightened as a culture that kind of provocative sentence can just go unnoticed. I mean, people really glommed on to that particular line, and many people, you know, admonished her and told, you know, and said in their letters to us that she should never be a parent, that someone who is that ambivalent and that negative about it should never, ever, ever, ever be a parent. I think, you know, again, and this is maybe because I edited the piece, but I found it very liberating and refreshing to hear someone say that.
Hmm.
And it's not necessarily what I believe or what I personally, but I felt that it was important that she was able to say it and say it without fear.
Right. And she mentions, I think, that when this appeared on Salon, she heard from a number of women who had actually regretted having children, who felt like they had maybe made a mistake in becoming mothers, and that was something they could admit to absolutely no one, and that somehow for them to read her article was something of a comfort, or maybe affirmed that they weren't crazy for having those sorts of thoughts.
That was the one perspective and that we could not get into this collection. I think that is a taboo that still exists and will probably exist for a long time. I tried very hard to find a writer, even someone who would publish anonymously about that exact fact that they had regretted having their child. And while we got some anonymous letters to that effect, and certainly Michelle did in response to her article, I think that it's still so, I think that expression would be so radical, even in this day and age, that no one wanted to touch it even anonymously.
Hmm. Although it's interesting, we know that there have to be plenty of people out there.
Yeah.
In fact, she cites an Ann Landers readers poll, which is certainly nothing scientific at all.
Right.
But she apparently posed to her readers, if you had to do it over again, would you have children? And 70% of those who responded to that question said no. Again, that's not a scientific question. I mean, it was a question that probably opened a floodgate for those who could not express that any other way. But nonetheless, it is some indication that it is not a terribly uncommon experience.
Yes, and that's one of the things, the letter that sort of moved me and the other editors at Salon the most that we received in response to the original series was from a mother whose son was severely emotionally disturbed and violent and had to have, you know, really extensive psychiatric care. He was a teenager. And she admitted in this anonymous letter to us that if she could do it over again, she would not choose to be a mother. And it's incredibly powerful to hear someone say that. It's not something you hear every day. And it's also very, I found it, well, a knee-jerk reaction might be to judge someone like that. When I read her letter, which was very, just filled with personal details and really long and really emotional, I really felt that it was beyond judgment.
You know, it reminds me of my own personal situation. My wife and I were not able to have children because of, let's call it, plumbing trouble. That's how I usually put it to people.
Right.
But even ahead of that reality in our own lives, I remember some ambivalent feelings when I thought about whether or not I might someday be a father. And to me, it's not even so much that I imagined that I might be the father to someone who might get into terrible, terrible trouble. I never got in trouble at all as a young person. Mm-hmm. Just hard for me to imagine that my offspring might, although I suppose such a thing is possible. Anything's possible. But I could really imagine being the parent of someone who might really be sort of out of step with their peers and picked on and suffer all of those painful realities of life. And to me, that was one of the hardest things to contemplate, that being a father, being a mother, would mean taking on all of the pain that a child experiences. And some people have the thick skin to do that, and I wasn't sure that I have it. To this day, I'm not sure I possess that.
Right. And I think that's something, again, I think that it, you know, I've heard from a lot of parents of teenagers who go through that once their kids get to middle school or, you know, in that age group when kids become really mean and cruel. And the daily struggles that their child is going through, of course, becomes their own. And it's incredibly difficult to remove yourself and to not feel personally devastated by it as a parent.
Something else is mentioned in this really interesting essay. It's the very first one in the book by Michelle Goldberg.
Mm-hmm.
She cites the writing of someone named Madeline Kane, who's written a book called The Childless Revolution, What It Means to Be Childless Today. And one of the things that apparently is suggested in that book is that a lack of interest in childbearing might very well have some sort of biological component. And Michelle Goldberg says maybe a little bit like being gay, not to connect those two experiences directly, but that in the same way that most scientists believe there is some sort of biological component in sexual orientation, that likewise one's interest or disinterest in being a parent, feeling or not feeling a drive to do so, might have a similar sort of biological component. I wonder what the reaction to that has been.
Well, I think I'm not intimately familiar with that research except for what, you know, the parts of it that Michelle and I discussed when she was writing the essay. But I think it's incredibly compelling. I think it's also interesting that research, to my knowledge, hasn't gotten a lot of attention in the same way that, as you know, an example, you know, as for example, the question of whether being gay is biological has gotten a lot of attention. But it's certainly compelling, and I think that maybe if that research was replicated and maybe, you know, explored more deeply and publicized more, there would be an even bigger shift in the way that we think about these questions of parenthood, and that it might become ultimately a lot more socially acceptable if people could understand a lack of interest or desire or drive to become a parent as something that was biological. We might have a small, you know, we might have a whole new set of, you know, these questions might become even more interesting, but also easier.
Yeah. Cary Tennis, in his book, It's Not in My Nature to Nurture, touches on this as well. He says, perhaps, talking about this sort of disinterest, he says, perhaps it's a little like being gay. You're just this certain way, and it doesn't feel strange to you, but it's different from the way most people are. And you might be curious to have what they have, but you're not driven to strive for it.
Right. And I think it's interesting because when you talk to women in particular, because I think that this biological drive to have children is something that many women feel, that, you know, I certainly felt it around the time that I turned 30, something that had once been very much, you know, again, part of my life's plan. I knew since I was young that I wanted to be a mother, took on a very biological urge at around 30. It coincided, it probably had to do with my age, it probably had to do with the fact that I had recently met, you know, and fallen in love with my husband. But that's a difficult thing to describe to someone who hasn't felt it themselves, but it did feel very primal and sort of beyond words. It was clearly much more about biology. And if you think about it, if, as Cary said, if there's an opposite to that, which is no urge, no biological need, it makes a lot of sense. If some people have that drive and some don't, then why would you go ahead with an undertaking as huge and monumental and life-altering as parenthood if you didn't feel some underlying urge? And that's a decision and a choice that we have now that we didn't used to have.
It's interesting. Michelle Goldberg cites all kinds of studies which indicate that there is absolutely no basis to believe that parents are happier than non-parents.
Yeah.
I mean, that simply does not bear up. And I'll raise my hand as Exhibit A.
Yeah.
I mean, as someone who has only golden retrievers, but a very full, wonderful life, as does my wife. But a couple of the essays of people who have made the decision not to have children, not a decision not made for them, but that they've decided not to have children, touch on some of the ways in which it does, of course, represent a loss. And one of them I wanted to ask you about, Leslie Dorman, in her essay called The Impossible Me, sort of touches on this question of, what have I missed out on by not being a parent? And most interesting, I think, in her essay is when she says, not being a parent, I have lost out on knowing the fuller story of my character. No one will ever count on me in so final a way as a child counts upon a mother or father. No sons or daughters will ask me to cough up guitar lessons, college tuition, mortgage money, or bail. I don't know how well or poorly I would have handled the pressure, the singularly demanding responsibility of shepherding a child into adulthood. Might motherhood have made a better woman out of me? I think that is so interesting. That is a way to think about this that had never occurred to me, and I suspect to other people as well.
I think I loved that essay for that reason, is because she really, really, really explores and tries to untie that question, which is, Leslie's an accomplished writer. She's had a long career, you know, writing for magazines. She has a new book of short stories out. She's a beautiful writer in person. And she was, by any measure, she is a lovely, wonderful, rich life. And yet, in her 50s, she's contemplating this question. And it's unanswerable. It's absolutely unanswerable. And yet there's a melancholy and a wistfulness about what she might have been had she been a mother. Not exactly regret, though. more of a deep questioning. And I think what was interesting, another essay in the first portion of the book, which is by the people who chose not to have children, is by a reporter named Eleanor Burkett. Eleanor is, I think, roughly Leslie's age. She's in her 50s as well. But she's had, her essay is almost defiant in the sense that she's had this globe-trotting career as a foreign correspondent. She's traveled all over the world. She's happily married. She's never once had that, or at least not that she explores in her essay, that sense of what if, that wistfulness. And I think really it's a question, it's not that one of them regrets it. I don't think either one of them regrets not being a mother. I think it's just the sense that Leslie, at this point in her life, is turning over that question. And I think that the question that she asks, what would motherhood have made a better woman out of me? I think that ultimately the answer is it would have made a different woman, and not better or worse. And those are questions, again, that we, you know, and I as an editor, hadn't heard a lot of people asking or at least writing about, and I wanted to get to the bottom of it because I think it's important.
Absolutely. We're speaking with Lori Leibovich about the book she edited, Maybe Baby, 28 essays by 28 different writers on this fascinating topic. The middle section of the book, called On the Fence, explores exactly that, various writers who remain undecided, at least to some extent, on whether or not they are going to undertake this, that is, parenthood. One of the writers of one of the most provocative essays, Rick Moody, his essay is called Bloodthirsty Dwarves, which is kind of an interesting way to look at potential children. But one of the things I especially enjoyed in this essay is when he said, what I like now in his life is responsibility. What I liked when I was young was liberty. And that, in a sense, is, for many people at least, sort of the tipping point or the fulcrum of the debate is our draw towards liberty and fun and being able to determine what we eat and when we eat and where we'll eat and so on, versus the draw towards responsibility, which is also, for many people, a very powerful draw in one way or another.
Yeah. I thought that he really got to that that question really beautifully in that essay. And I think that, again, maybe it's the male version of the biological clock, is that at a certain point you turn a corner, whether it's when you're 30 or 35 or 40 or whenever, and you decide that you've played out the liberty part of your life and that it's been fantastic, but maybe it's time, or maybe there's a desire there to sort of, as we say, settle down, put down roots, be a little more grounded physically in our worlds. What I thought was interesting and poignant and beautiful about Rick's essay, and a couple of the other writers touched on this too, was that his own life circumstances also dictated this wanting to return, or this desire for more stability. And that was that his sister was killed in a car accident, and he felt after that he wanted, you know, she left behind children, and his purpose, you know, his life obviously was altered irrevocably, and he was very much wanted to protect her children.
And the niece who was five and the nephew who was seven.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to also add to their lives by producing more family members and to have more children in their family and to sort of come up, you know, to sort of replace some of the tragedy with some joy. And a couple of the other writers touched on this in different ways, in that some of them spoke about being the children of very awful parents and having the desire to do it again better for their own children. If they could, and at least to try to do that. So
I was intrigued by Larry Smith's chapter, The Daddy Dilemma, in which he, at one point, describing the ambivalence of he and his wife saying, we don't know if we want to have children. I'm about 65% for procreation. She's about 70% against.
Yeah.
And at another point in the essay, those numbers shift just ever so slightly, but it's kind of intriguing. I certainly don't operate that way. I don't know how many people do where I could actually attach a numerical designation into how much I do or do not want to be a dad.
Yeah, he's a funny guy. And I think what I liked about that essay was he's very practical and you know, and that obviously comes through in those numerical terms. But what was interesting about his situation and continues to be interesting because I'm in touch with him and so he still is on the fence. They are still on the fence 3 years later, is that he, you know, in a lot of cases with men who are maybe a little bit ambivalent about parenthood, it's the woman whose biological, emotional, psychological needs are going to push them over the edge because they desperately or really, really want children, and also their age and their need to get going with procreation kicks in, and so they sort of drive the discussion. In his relationship, his wife is in her late 30s and really doesn't feel the pull as much as he does. It's sort of a flip side of the general debate we hear about the, you know, having a biological clock. His biological clock's a little bit louder than hers, and he feels it's almost incumbent upon him to decide for them. She'll go along. She'll do it if he agrees to be really co-parent, to be 100% her partner. She will not do it if he doesn't really, really commit to that. And so they're still struggling with it. That was an interesting...
Yeah. I'm reminded of a little chapter of my own life that that I feel like I want to share if I can. My younger brother, he and his partner have adopted a beautiful little boy from Cambodia.
Uh-huh.
And the first time they came to visit us, one of the things that worried me was what that experience would be like if I would feel then a real compulsion, kind of a jealousy of the wonderful happiness which they are experiencing as a family. And what worried me almost more was if I would feel one reaction and my wife would feel another. Mm. And if we would be suddenly on different ends of the teeter-totter when up until that moment we had pretty much, very much been at peace with where we were, that we couldn't have children of our own and didn't feel a strong need to adopt or whatever. And so that worried me. The only time in that whole trip visit I was when we looked at a picture album of other orphans from this orphanage in Cambodia. And I had a big twinge at that moment. But otherwise, I mostly felt like this is so great for Steve. Mm-hmm. I don't picture this for me somehow. And but as they drove off, I'm thinking, oh, I wonder what Kathy's thinking. And they had not even left our block.
Yeah.
And Kathy turned to me and said, this is so great for them, but I don't think it's for me or for us. So I don't remember how she said it, but she said exactly what I had also been thinking. And as relieved as I was in that moment, as I read your book, I think about all the couples who are not so blessed to be on the same page.
Yeah.
I think what a difficult situation that would be.
And I think you're absolutely right. And I think that often one, you know, a storyline that I've heard again and again from people who are going through the grueling, expensive, long process of infertility treatments is when to stop. And if one partner still is committed to going forward and one partner is ready to stop, that can be incredibly, incredibly difficult for a marriage, for a partnership. So I feel your story is, you know, it's a blessing. It's great that you both felt that same sense.
Well, and one theme which comes up quite a lot in, and maybe it's important that we say that a lot of this book is very positive.
Yes.
It's not all about angst.
Yes, let's say
that. And again, and Larry Smith in his essay at one point says, happiness comes in many varieties. And that probably takes us back to one of our first points about this whole topic, which is that once upon a time it was generally thought that the only path and the best path towards happiness has to include being a parent.
Right. Right.
And the suggestion now is that there are many ways to be happy and to be fulfilled, and some of those ways have nothing to do with being a parent.
No, there are many different narratives, and as the research that Michelle Goldberg cites suggests, that you know, people without children are actually happier a lot of the time than people with children.
Hmm.
But I do want to emphasize, because, and thank you for bringing it up, that there are a slew of essays in this book by parents who are overjoyed at the and really, really satisfied with their lives as parents. One of the essays that comes to mind for me is by a writer named Peter Nichols, who's also a nonfiction writer, who found himself in love at 50 after two failed marriages. He found himself in love, meeting someone when he was living in Paris, researching a book. They fell in love very quickly, had a child almost immediately, and he finds himself, you know, in his early 50s in a life that he never imagined, which is, again, living in a coastal town in Maine, writing books and with a young son, and describing that the sense of contentedness that he never knew was possible. And that was another thing that happened to us when we posted the original series in Salon, was that a huge percentage of the letters we got and were what we called conversion stories, which were people who had a lot of fears and anxieties about parenthood, but sort of jumped off the cliff and had it and did it anyway, and couldn't imagine their lives any other way. Which is not to say that those essays are all simple and tied up in neat little bows, but it is. I did want to emphasize that there are some really, really beautiful meditations on parenthood in this book as well.
You're right, and Peter Nichols is so great. It's called "We'll Always Have Paris," because he talks about how he earlier in his life would be among what he calls the time privileged,
yes,
those who are not up to their eyeballs in diapers and everything else that goes with parenthood. And he says there's now not time for trips to London and Rome, time in which to write, not to mention walking, running, working out. Those things are part of a former life. People tell us such times will come again. Enjoy this precious time, they say again. We'll try, but when will it be over, please?
Yeah.
I want to give you a chance to talk about one other essay in this section, sure, of the book, which takes us a little bit away from what we think of as traditional parenthood. It's actually the first chapter in this book called Taking the Leap. Amy Benfer.
Yeah.
She is a teenage girl when she gives birth, 16 years old, and her essay begins with a very dramatic moment when she made a decision 4 days after her daughter was born.
Yeah. Amy, when she was 16 years old, became pregnant. She lived in Idaho at the time, was in high school, was doing beautifully in high school, had a supportive family, two loving parents, a younger brother, pretty basic suburban life, and had a lot of ambitions for herself, and her parents had a lot of ambitions for her. And she got pregnant, and almost everyone in her life, doctors, social workers, people around her, advised her, maybe not always explicitly, but really felt that she should give this baby up for adoption, that if she had it, her life would be compromised beyond belief, and that she wouldn't be able to go on to do great things, and that there was going to be a loving family somewhere that would gladly take and raise her baby. And almost in the spirit of teenage rebellion rather than logical thinking, she decided that because everyone was telling her that she should give the baby away, that was just one of the many reasons why she should keep the baby. And she did. And she ended up raising her daughter with her family. She stayed in high school. She still went away to college. She went away to college in Connecticut and was able to secure housing and an apartment and childcare for her and her daughter, while she went to college. And she didn't compromise any of her ambitions or dreams for herself. She made it work so that she could be the woman she wanted to be and raise a daughter. And it certainly wasn't always easy. She's now in her 30s, and so she has a teenager. I think her daughter probably now is getting ready to go to college herself. But it was a very unlikely decision. It was a very difficult decision, and she very readily admits that she wasn't always the best mother, probably, that she was sort of growing up at the same time that her daughter was and working through her adolescent rebellions and her sort of selfish desires to do what she wanted to do, and she never compromised. She took her daughter everywhere she went, and she did what she wanted to do, and she became a writer and lives in New York now. And it's not the story you usually hear about the troubled teenage mom who has to, you know, give up their child. She
right.
did it differently.
There are two striking things. One is the way she describes that moment of decision. She says, my daughter was 4 days old on the day I decided to be her parent.
Mm-hmm.
My father was in the driver's seat. I was a 16-year-old when I made the announcement, let's go get her.
Yeah.
We're going to get the baby, my father said, and drove over a wall of traffic cones to cross over into the turn lane. And that was that. Me, my parents, my younger brother, all of us went on this reckless mission to pick up a newborn baby we'd left with my mother's single friend until we'd figure out what in the world to do. We were all crying. And she also mentions the fact that although in one way she was a single parent, she didn't think of herself that way at all,
yeah.
because she had her family around her helping in all kinds of different ways to make this work.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary story and certainly unusual, and certainly she had a lot of benefits that a lot of other teenage moms don't have, but it still took an incredible amount of guts to do it, and she did it.
Absolutely. There's also, we don't really have time to talk about it, but a beautifully crafted piece by Catherine Harrison called Cradle to Grave, which is so interesting, in which she speaks about the experience of parenting her own child while at the same time shepherding her very, very difficult grandmother through the end of her life. And an experience with, of course, a lot of people have of sort of parenting in two different directions and parenting the person who parented them. And that's a very poignant comment on this, what this experience can sometimes be for people.
Yeah, that essay is incredibly beautiful. And Catherine's grandmother had raised her, basically. And as, you know, as often is the case when we are taking care of elderly relatives, her grandmother came to live with her for the end of her life. Catherine cared for her in her home almost until the end of her life, and it was coincided with her having her first baby. And so there's some incredible scenes in that essay of her trying to balance essentially parenting an old, you know, shepherding an older, her old grandmother who was incredibly crotchety and difficult to her death, while she's also trying to shepherd this newborn in her life, into life. And it just speaks a lot to these cycles and to the sort of similarities between ushering someone into the world and ushering someone out. And it was quite moving.
That experience, which another writer in an essay called My Tribe calls our big adventure.
Yes.
That of being parents. Well, the book, again, is called Maybe Baby, 28 essays by 28 different writers, and it's published by Harper and edited by Lori Leibovich, and is something that I just can't imagine someone not picking up and just thoroughly enjoying as I did. It is such a thought-provoking book. Again, the title is Maybe Baby. And Lori Leibovich, I really appreciate your time in putting this book together and for talking about it today on The Morning Show. I very much appreciate it. Best wishes.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
In the podcast version of The Morning Show, you will be able to hear this interview actually in its entirety. So subscribe to The Morning Show with Greg Berg to hear all of my interview with Lori Leibovich talking about this really terrific book. And both of the podcast morning shows this weekend will also be related to Mother's Day. One of them, a book titled A Potent Spell, talks about how much being fearful for the well-being of our children is wrapped up in modern-day motherhood. Also, a look at adoption with the author of a fascinating book called Adoption.